That's right.
And we're fortunate to be able to do that because we are situated here at the corner of 6th and Bullard in beautiful downtown Silver City, Karma Corner.
That's right. The home of the New Mexico Yodel.
That, among many other things. So, we are very, very blessed today because we have a cast of amazing thespians. T-H-E-S, yeah. In case you're wondering. So, Scott Plate is here with, right. I'm sorry, you're going to have to introduce
Monty.
Montelius Valenzuela. A lot of people call me Monty.
Okay, and?
Cesar Acosta, but it's Hispanic, so say it that way, please.
You got it.
All right.
Cesar.
Well.
Yes, okay.
So, you got to move the microphone closer.
Never been to one of these before.
So, Monty, you're about to become a superstar in a major theatrical production taking place in our area beginning in about a week.
Yep.
So why don't you let our listeners know what your role is and what the play is?
Okay, so it's a one-man show, and the one man in the show is myself playing Tom Paine. And it's not the historical revolutionary Tom Paine. It's based on nothing. And my role, I would like to simply describe it as someone who doesn't know if he wants to know who he really is, or if he wants anyone else out there to know who he really is, but someone who doesn't know how not to try. Huh. That's sort of the best, most simple, clear explanation I can give. It can be difficult sometimes to try to say like who your character is and what their biggest goal is or what they're trying to do, because it evolves so much as you go throughout the process. But that's kind of what I got as far as who he is. He's no one, really, on the outside. But I'm sure people will come to find that he's got a lot to unpack, like the rest of us do. There's a quote from the play, and it says, he's just like you, or he is you, or he isn't, and he doesn't like you. So, if that makes sense, yeah. Great. If it doesn't,
makes sense to
come
me.
Get more of that at the show.
Right. If you can follow that, you should read Gravity's Rainbow, too, because that will make sense to you.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Scott Plate is the director for this, correct?
Yes.
So, pull up your microphone, Scott. You've had some prior experience with this.
I have, actually. And I thought mine did a nice job right there of describing something about the show that's essential. And I think Ken did a nice job of referencing Thomas Pynchon, which right. I think is a nice way of talking about this. So the history I have for the show is I did this role 20 or just a little less than 20 years ago at a theater in Ohio, not long after it was published. And so... It was a beautiful piece of theater, and I watched Monty work in town and thought, you know, he's young for the role, but he's right for it, and he's also really talented, so why not stretch? So the role, it's nice for me to be able to watch him fly in this process and grow every day and take on a text that is very difficult. It's nonlinear. It kind of hopscotches around because what the playwright Will Eno does is manage to write whatever everyone would never really get caught dead saying out loud. So there's a lot of inner life going on that doesn't have a nice coherent linear structure. So for an actor, it's difficult to learn this. But Monty showed up for the first rehearsal completely off book. Which is what a professional does, and it's enabled us to get a lot of work done very quickly, you know, so we can go deeper in the process. But I'm really excited to see where he goes from where we are now till opening. And I'm really more excited to find out where he lands on closing night, because the missing ingredient in this piece, the essential ingredient in this piece, is an audience. Because the play needs that interaction, really needs that interaction. And the character needs that relationship. Right. So it's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, it's fun to look in a mirror and practice, but it doesn't do much.
Bathroom know. Perfect isn't perfect.
Right.
Right.
You know. Good for you, man.
So I have a question for you. Being the only individual in the play, I mean, how is that? I mean, I know I've done like almost zero acting, but I know how much I relied on the other characters to fill in or help me out if I messed up. So I'd like to hear how you feel about being like the only one out there.
I'd say, like anything, it could be great. It can be terrible sometimes. It depends on the type of day you've had. But I think at the end of every day, the kind of beautiful thing that you can resort to is that with every play, every type of piece of art that you do, there's usually an effort to connect or communicate or provoke the people who are viewing said piece of art, right? And in this play, it's not about a bunch of things going on stage and hoping that somehow it connects to the audience. It's about a man in a place that happens to be a theater desperately trying to connect with each and every one of these people. And it takes away from what's going on the stage and just brings it right to you. So it's kind of one of those things that, like, if you think about it too hard, you might lose kind of your touch with it. So it's just, I don't know. It's a tricky thing, definitely. Sometimes I find myself kind of lacking that sort of rhythm or magic that you usually have whenever you have someone else to bounce off of. Because a lot of times it's like in a play, they do something and you can work really hard so that that can really organically, authentically affect you and what you're going to do next, how you're going to react. But I think you have to rely a lot on yourself, and you have to, as Scott puts it, drive your energy towards the end of the sentence so that whatever you're saying next really is, like I said, an organic and authentic product of what you just said or did or felt before. So, I mean, you do that all the time in regular plays, but it's good to really have it like hyper-focused, you know? And you can't always have that sort of hyper-focus in from doing plays with other people all the time.
If I could throw something in there, I think that's a really good answer to that question, Monty. The other thing is, what's kind of genius about the play is it's designed for the character to have that strange experience of being alone in the world. So he's, you know, we imagine he spends a lot of time alone. He might even not have a home. We don't know. There's not anything autobiographical about him that's clear except for what he shares. But that sense of I'm alone up here translates to how we understand him feeling really alone in the world. And he tries to overcome that in the play by making sincere connections with the audience, sometimes in really challenging and, as Monty says, provoking ways. But it's the whole play is designed for the actor to feel completely like a fish out of water so they can have that real experience of the piece. Yeah.
In case you're just tuning in, we're talking to Monty Valenzuela, Scott Plate, and Mr. Acosta. I'm terrible with first names.
No, I'm terrible with names in general. I get it, man.
So
Caesar.
Caesar Acosta, first All name, right. last name.
So what's your role in this?
I'm running the light cues and maybe like very small like interaction cues besides that. But for the most part, I'm going to be specializing towards the technology of the play.
Promotion, dude.
And promotion. I'm also a promotion in the promotion team. I do a lot of that around Silver City. It's very fun.
Well, you certainly got a lot of notices put up. You're doing a great job.
Yeah, Caesar works hard. Don't let him be modest. He's great. That's what he does.
I do my best.
So when you say interaction with the audience, is that like actual physical interaction? Or, I mean, I think of like Rocky Horror Picture Show where, you know, people scream and yell and dress up and
throw things.
And the old melodramas at the Buckhorn where they'd sell popcorn to be thrown. So is it that kind of interaction or just like an emotional and mental interaction with them?
So the part that we were thinking for Caesar, I almost don't want to get
it.
Yeah, I don't want to spill it because it might mess up some things for some people. But it's something subtle. It's not like a huge deal. It's definitely not. I wouldn't say it's as vulgar as like throwing popcorn or anything like that. But it is entertaining. Like I said, we may not have him in that role, but it's definitely a consideration. As being a very important part of the play.
I'll throw something in there. I appreciate that Monty doesn't want to spill the beans on this one because it's an important moment that the audience needs to discover. So to answer your question, yes, there is direct interaction with the audience in a way that might make people really realize that they've never had someone, an actor, walk up to them on the stage and begin engaging them directly and really require a response. So there's a lot of that on purpose. It's not gratuitous. It's written into the show because it's about trying to find a clear path towards sincere relationships, you know, embodied by a person who has really struggled with that his whole life because of how he came up. And he's very clear about that. Like, these are the things that happened to me. This is why I am what I am, but I'm going to try anyway to connect with you. Might be awkward sometimes, but let's just do it, okay? So that's that piece. But there are some interactions that are more physical in nature. You know, I wouldn't say hurtful or dangerous or any of those lines, any of those types. But Cesar might be involved in some of those.
Yeah. The bits that I have are just the ones that are like, like how they said, it's really subtle. For the most part, I will, though, be sticking to like lights and promotion. I'm very excited to be part of it. I love working with Monty. I can't wait to see how this will turn out. And I really hope you guys can see the actor that I see in Monty. He's a splendid actor. He embodies his parts perfectly.
Thanks, man.
I'll totally second that. And also, you know, Monty is producing this play, I would say probably with Cesar. The two of them together have taken on a lot of the responsibility for getting the word out, and Cesar is doing a lot of work behind the scenes. The flyers you see around town are largely their work. This opportunity to be here is also Monty and Cesar's work. So they've also, you know, invested their own money in making this actually possible. So I just want to tip my hat to that. So this is a homegrown, self-produced, really kind of exquisite piece of theater that deserves the attention of the community because people are taking risks and with a risk, there is usually a reward. And my hope for Monty and Cesar and everybody who's behind the scenes is that they get a sense of that satisfaction.
All right. Well, Cesar, why don't you give our listeners the details, where and when, and where can people get tickets?
All right. So where is the Buckhorn Saloon and Opera? 32 Main Street, Pinos Altos, New Mexico. The performances are June 1 through 30. Thursday and Friday, the times are 7 p.m. Saturday and Sunday, the times are 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. The doors will open 30 minutes prior, and if you want to reserve tickets ahead of time, you can call or text the number 575-956-7429, or you can message the email tompainbonticket@gmail.com, which would be tompainbonticket@gmail.com.
All right. Well, you know, we like to give our listeners a heads up and give them a chance to go get a pencil. So we didn't give him that opportunity, so we're going to give him that opportunity now. We're going to wait.
All right.
Wait a minute, and you can give out the phone number and the email address again. All right. Has everyone gotten their pencil out there? You know, I know it's early, but you still had enough time to get your coffees. So, all right. I think they've had enough time.
All right.
If they haven't, they can report to the principal's office.
The place is the Buckhorn Saloon and Opera House, 32 Main Street, Pinos Altos, New Mexico. The performances are June 1 through 30.
First through 30th.
The times are Thursday and Friday at 7 p.m. and Saturday and Sunday at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. Doors will open 30 minutes prior. If you want to reserve tickets ahead of time, you should call or text the number 575-596-7249.
956-7429.
Okay, let me just repeat that.
Good idea. That's everything you know about the number.
Reserve texts ahead of time. If you want, you have to call 575-956-7249. Or the email tompainbondticket@gmail.com, which is spelled tompainbondticket@gmail.com.
All right. It's an acronym. Tom Payne, B-O-N, is based on nothing.
Right on. Thanks, Caesar.
Thanks, Caesar.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
It's kind of a lot. It's just like, I'm familiar with all that, so I'm sorry.
It's fine. Part of that's because I'm blind.
In case you're just joining us, we're talking about Tom Payne, a play which is going to start being shown up at Buckhorn Saloon and Opera House on Saturday, June 1st, which would be 2 weeks from this Saturday. In getting ready for this interview, I saw one comment about this play. It's by an entity called Theater Mania, and it says, at the conclusion of the play, the audience members may not know exactly what they just saw or what it was supposed to mean. Is Tom Payne a meditation on disappointment, an exercise in futility? Perhaps both. One thing is certain, however, even if the piece is based on nothing, as its subtitle proclaims, its unconventional style makes it far more interesting than many other plays that are currently on the board. Would you say that that's a fair summary?
I would. I think that there's the integrity. There's integrity that I'm going to go after in doing this play. I definitely don't want to turn it into something that people will understand. because I think that'd be a disrespect to them. And I think that they will be able to understand it once I get towards the show date. Of course, if they saw it right now, maybe not. But
they'd still get a pretty
good
show. Yeah,
they would. It would be all right. But the thing is that me and Scott are going to work our hardest, our absolute hardest, to give the play the respect it deserves and to also have it be objectively proficient enough to where people can understand it. So I'm fairly faithful that people will walk away from this play knowing what they saw. But if they don't, and I give it everything I had, it's just kind of one of those things that you just kind of have to accept and hope that maybe they'll think on it, maybe they'll come back. So yeah, I think there's a real possibility that some people might go, what was that? What just happened? I got nothing from that. But That's kind of one of the fears of every actor and of every human. You could be going to see your lover or your friend, and you're just hoping to God, I hope that this doesn't mean nothing to them. I hope that what I'm doing means something. I hope that I'm enough. And I hope that, that sort of energy can kind of bleed through during the play. But I almost feel that I'm being too easy on myself by explaining it. You know, it's almost as if I should just let it be. And if people do feel that, which they might, it's all right.
The one thing I can add to what Monty's saying, and I appreciate his restraint and his commitment to integrity, is if you want to see it, come back again. if it's a lot to take in the first time, there are 28 performances in the entire month of June. So come back again.
It's 28 times.
I had, when I did it back in the day, somebody came, I think, 12 times. That was the record.
Right.
that was a little probably masochistic, but, you know.
Uh-huh.
No, it was kind of interesting that just somebody who really loved theater, who really loved language, 12 times. It was like, whoa, back again. Cool. All right. But yeah, I would encourage people to think about seeing it more than once.
Yeah.
It's a really beautiful meditation on all the things that Monty just said. So.
Well, I don't want to put any real pressure on you, Monty. I would encourage you not to read the various reviews that Scott got when he did this in 2007.
I know. I had a friend when I first picked, I was away, and I got in contact with Scott. And I was like, Scott, I think I want to do this play. And when I started memorizing it, I told a friend of mine, like, I'm going to do the show, and I'm excited about it. And he was like, dude, I read about the show. Don't do the show. And I was like, I think I'm still going to do it. It kind of made me want to do it more. But yeah, he had gone online and read some reviews, and he stumbled across some people who just didn't want to try, you know? Or I guess they weren't in the frame of mind that the performer would hope the audience to be when they come and see the show. And he was like, Monty, please, I think you should take something lighter. You should take something less aggressive. But yeah, I don't know. It's worth it.
Well, how did the two of you find each other?
Scott?
Ooh.
Yeah. So we were on a beach. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. No. Scott had
the
actually
sea breezes were.
Yeah. It was on a mountain.
In the Himalayas.
We were in a little mountain town. I was doing Beyond the Horizon by Eugene O'Neill 2 years ago at you know. Coincidentally enough, the Buckhorn Saloon and Opera House, and he walked in there, and maybe you'd seen me before. But he walked in, and he just kind of watched us rehearse. I was directing all these kids, all these teenagers at the time, and he just came up to me and said, hey, I really like what you're doing here. I'm having some dinner with some friends. I've been doing theater for a long time, and I'm going to donate to your cause. And he gave me some money, and it helped pay for some of the stuff as we got closer to opening for that show. And then later on, he saw some of my plays at the Starlight, and then I ran into you at Chocolate Fantasia, which is like 100 yards from here. And he's like, hey, Monty, I have this play that I did a while back. You could do it 10 years from now. You could do it whenever. Just tell me whenever you'd like to be directed in it. And that's kind of the intro to the Monty Scott relationship.
Beach story.
Yeah, the beach story.
Add to it. So all of what Monty said. So the first time I walked into the Buckhorn, I was just showing some friends the Opera House because it's a kind of a cool space. And Monty wasn't the first person I met. I just walked in there. It's normally empty. And there were a bunch of high school kids running around, like seriously in the theater mode. And I'm like, well, I'm sorry for interrupting. What's happening? Oh, we're doing a show in Montelius, which is the first time I heard that name, is directing us. And I said, oh, what's the show? And he said, Beyond the Horizon. I'm like, that's not a small piece of theater. It's a big 2.5-3 hour chunk of adult portion theater. They're producing it. And he said they were all kind of contributing tips from Sonic and all that kind of stuff and putting it up on their own. So I went back to the table where I was over and was trying to explain to my friends, I'm like, there's these kids that are producing the show by themselves using tips from Sonic. So we basically took up a collection, emptied our wallets, and then went back. And that time I met Monty. And, he thanked us profusely, and he said it would help. You know, and I'm like, that's good, because I think what you're doing is incredible, and it should be supported. And then the rest of it he told. So, I think it's what's important is, you know, for anyone, I don't know, I think he's unusual in any place because he's got a vision beyond what he's doing. And he has dreams of doing something extraordinary, and I think he'll achieve them. But, yeah, so we started working together. He thought about it for a couple of years because he had finished school and then COVID and going abroad and that kind of stuff. And I appreciate that you took time with it before you said yes.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to do something that I could really get my fingers in without having to rely. You know, a lot of times with the play, you have to rely on other people. They have to be with you at that time. You have to communicate with them. And I was like, well, it's just me here. I'm overseas. I don't have any. I'm just here by myself. I might as well get started on something. So that when I come back to town, I come back, like, ready, you know, with whatever I've learned on the trip. So, yeah.
So this is really interesting. How did you become involved in theater in the first place?
Ooh. I remember seeing, like, Wendy Spurgeon doing a lot of theater. I would hear them on the radio sometimes talking about stuff they were doing, or I'm not sure if they were doing radio shows at that time. But I think the first kind of, like, intro that I had to theater was just, like, high school drama. And I did that when I was a freshman. And then when I was a sophomore, kind of late freshman, all through sophomore year, into the earlier part of my junior year, I tried to chase that whole, like, online auditioning with, like, an agent and stuff like that. And then I realized that I could be doing stuff here while I'm still here. And so I just started producing my own stuff. But, yeah, just high school drama, really. And I can't really pinpoint. Maybe it was because I, like, dressed up in costumes when I was a kid, or I played with action figures and I told a lot of stories. Maybe that's kind of where it stemmed from. But, yeah, it's kind of not the most miraculous start to something, but it's kind of how a lot of people start, you know?
Well, in case you're just turning in, we're listening to Montelius Valenzuela talking about Tom Paine, a play that's going to be opening at the Buckhorn Theater on June 1st, 2 weeks from tomorrow. And I think that it's really important. I need to emphasize a couple of things here. First of all, Monte met Scott 100 yards away from our studio. Further proof about the karma,
right,
which is generated by the corner of 6th and Bullard. On top of that, Monte became heavily influenced in theatrical productions by listening to KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico. Coincidence? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either, you know.
Well,
it's the spirit.
Well, yeah.
That comes through here, and it goes beyond 100 yards anyway. It covers most of Grant County and parts of Catron County as well. You know, it's we may see a lot more people coming up and becoming interested in this, you know. I mean, because, you know, everywhere you go, you spread any spirit you have within you, you know. Mm-hmm. And I remember one time my wife and I played up in Tierra Amarilla, and our sound system started burning. And years later, I was at a place at a graduation where people just passed their bar, and this kid comes up and he says, "Oh, I saw you guys. I was in high school in Tierra Amarilla." And he says, "You guys had that great show where you made your sound system burn up." And I says, "Well, we didn't make it do it. It just did it." He says, "But you went on and you sang in Spanish and French and all these languages." And he says, "You know, you changed my life. That's why I'm a lawyer today." I said, "Oh, my God. Oh, no. What did we do?" You know, but anyway.
I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
You know, that's, you know, what a burden.
I know, it was, you know. I felt guilty about that for a long time, but maybe he became a lawyer like you were, a good lawyer.
There's no such thing, as close as you can get
to that, anyway. I know it's difficult, but...
well, look.
You know, I mean, so anyway, that's like karma spreads this stuff around, and so that was, I must have been spreading negative karma that day up MTA, but... anyway, it was interesting to realize little things that happen, how they influence you.
Yeah.
You know.
That's true.
It is, you know. And
so, Ken, why don't you give our listeners instructions on how they can become a part of the spirit? They can join the force.
Well, if you live above Bullard, You can walk down to Bullard. If you live below Bullard, you can walk up to Bullard. And you can walk all the way over to 6th and Bullard. And there's two doors right next to each other on the southwest corner of Bullard and 6th. And 5119B is us. And you can come in here if somebody's in here and give them money. If the door's locked, sometimes you can wave and just point like you want to come in. And you can give us money. And you can give us a check as well.
And gold bars.
Gold bars, that's right. We take gold bars. And actually we take silver, whatever, you know, diamonds, whatever you got, you know.
But we don't take blood diamonds.
No, we don't take blood diamonds, no. And we don't take blood donations either, actually. But anyway, you can come down here, and if nobody is here, you can put a check made out to GMCR or a nominal full of $100 bills or $1 bills, whatever works for you. And you can put them in the postal slot on our door and put a little note in there with your name and stuff so we can call you up and remind you that you haven't done this for 3 or 4 days and maybe you want to do it again. Or maybe a month or maybe a year, I don't know, whatever. Time goes both directions. And so that's something you can do. Or you can go, like I said, you can go to gmcr.org and you can push on that donate button. And when you push on that donate button, you know that you'll be able to find many, many, many different pathways to a better karma.
All right. That's probably one of the longest stunning notices we've ever done.
Well, thank you. You know, it's free association, it's called.
Well, that's what happens when you get to the top of the Himalayas.
Right, I know.
Well, the one thing I just want to add to what Ken said is from my limited time being in Silver City, KURU is the very first entity to reach out when you want to do something. They're often like, how can we support you? How can we promote you? How can we get the word out? So in terms of sharing your spirit wherever you go, I think this radio station embodies what community radio really is all about.
Right.
So I would just encourage listeners to respond in kind. Because it's nice to be the first to be welcomed. So think of it, the station first when you think of what you want to give, because it's essential here.
Yeah, we support a lot of other aspects of the community, too, and other parts of the community. And it's and also, you know, we have to fill airtime, you know. So
that
it's
helps.
Good to have people come on, you know.
Content helps, right?
Yes, content helps, right.
Well, Scott Plate, you know, I can't let you go away without pointing out that you are a guy that does a huge number of things in this community. Well, why don't you let our listeners know a little bit more about what you do outside of theater?
Well, how I got to know George, honestly, was through LGBTQ Grant County, which is an organization I'm on the board, and my husband Cyril is the president of the board. I'm the secretary at the moment, and we're trying to create a presence for the LGBTQIA plus community and an advocacy organization for that. I work with End of Life Options New Mexico, and I'm an end of life doula. I help people die, and I'm also a coach. I help people who are actively trying to live, and I'm trying to figure out how to message a practice that really falls in that niche, because if I could have a dram of the energy that a person who's actively dying has to achieve goals before they go and drop that in the life of someone who's trying to live, work would be a lot easier. So I don't know. I came here in the middle of the pandemic in 2020 and just kind of shut up for a couple of years because my life before had been a very community profile life, actor, director, whatever, you know, and I didn't know this community and I kind of felt like, let me just listen for a while, and this is what talked back. So, and I have to say the efforts have been really, really welcomed by the community. I felt like I came back home, and I, even though I've never lived here before, my husband was born here. He wasn't raised here. He grew up upstate in a little town of like a couple hundred people called Thoreau, not far from Gallup. Really? You are the first person.
Yes, I actually lived there in the St. Bonaventure RV Park, right next to the railroad track.
What years?
oh gosh, this would have been 1987, 1988.
Okay. He had left by then. He went to New Mexico State on a track scholarship and then went back to teach at the high school. So, yeah.
Big town. Big town. Laundromat. We got a laundromat and an Alsup's.
I think there might be a stoplight now.
Hey, that's pushing you. But you know what? The driving past through going on up north from there, there's some beautiful, beautiful, beautiful country up there. Beautiful country.
It is gorgeous. And he talks about it's right on the southeastern edge of the Navajo Rest. So it's he talks about it being an amazing place to grow up, just like outdoors and safe and, you know, kind of boundless space. And you're and Chaco is about an hour and a bit north. It's a gorgeous kind of open I don't know, I loved it there, you know, going to, but it's to see where he came up.
I think one thing that's always gotten me though is the pronunciation of it because it's supposed to be Thoreau,
right?
It was named after Henry David Thoreau, but everybody calls it Thoreau,
right? Because if you blink you drive right through it.
There you go. But it's not spelled that way.
I know. Yeah, but so, this has been a lovely homecoming in a way for a place that's not been my home, but I kind of feel like I've been here before. It's a hard thing to explain, but I think most people who feel that way here don't need an explanation. No. It's like, no, they get it. So,
all right. So, what more can you tell us about play?
Why don't you talk about what it's like to learn it?
Memorize it?
Or just to learn this guy.
Oh, okay. To learn
like,
this
what's your own actor's journey through that?
It's kind of scary sometimes. It can be exhausting. It's also beautiful because I've come to find out that I'm more like this character than I kind of think that I deserve to be. Like, a lot of times you come across a role and you really have to mold yourself to imagine what it's like to live in those circumstances. And I think one of my favorite things about any role, but what's really highlighted in this show, is that this guy, Tom Payne, he's inside every single one of us. And I mean that with all of my heart. And that's kind of how every role is. But it's hyper noticeable with this guy. You come across something, you read into him, you look at what he says, how he says it, when he says it, what he says after, what he's doing, and you kind of realize I have all of this inside of me. I just need to tap into it. And there's definitely been a lot of times with Scott where it just feels like everything is falling into place, but you really have no control over it. I think that dude's going to throw a rock through the window. Oh, he did.
Tried to.
No, he just came in.
Should we?
No, we're fine.
We're fine. Keep that on.
Okay.
You know, that was a little surreal.
Well, I mean, there's a little bit of that guy in Tom Payne, too.
Right.
He's not going to throw a rock at you, but...
I don't think so.
Yeah, anyway, that was kind of crazy. Sorry, let's see. It's been difficult, but it's also been very easy. And I think it's just one of those things you got to just trust that it's going to happen, in terms of connecting with him. And, you can't just say, oh, things are confusing. They're confusing for Tom. This must be going exactly to plan. You kind of have to keep tabs on things. But I think with this role, I've had to let go of a lot of the control that I sort of have and, you know, just have faith that I'm going to connect with who he is and how that connects to me. But if we're running out of time, I'd like to say one more thing. Are we running out of time, Kyle?
No, we're not running out of time.
Oh, perfect. Okay, well, I'm going to just say this anyway before I forget. Thank you, Silver City. Thank you to you guys. It's kind of like unreal how supportive everyone is. Like the people on the street. We brought the rock in. Right on. It's a souvenir.
It's a nice rock.
It is. I thanked him, but he wasn't there.
It's unreal how like kind people are in the street when we give flyers out to them and all the shopkeepers and all the business owners. Like, everyone's just been great. And this play is already a task on its own. So everyone who's just been so supportive and excited and kind, like, thank you all. You guys keep me going. Yeah, that's about all I have to say.
Yeah.
What, Caesar, you got?
And I would kind of like to add on to what Monty's been saying about how not only has the community been super supportive of it, but also about like how he kind of has to like discover the part within himself and kind of mold himself towards it as well. Because there's this like this sense of spirit in community and theater, and it's kind of like our job as like actors and directors and techies and promoters to like make this environment where actors can act as this medium to summon both the spirit of like the people and the spirit of the part, the play, and that can be very difficult sometimes because the play is this ghost. It was already made. It's already on paper. It's already got this emotion from the person who made it. But it's still your job to bring it out. And even throughout the iterations and all the plays you do, develop it further every single time. And it can get very exhausting. You spend money, especially, blood, sweat, and tears, sometimes more than you'd want. Just to bring it out for people to see, and even with all of it out and like summoned and on display, it's still up to the people to look at that and take something from it. And this community is super, super supporting of it, and I'm very glad to be a part of it. I really am.
I got a question.
For Cesar, actually, thank you for that. What's it like to live with your friend while he's working on this?
We get up early, we sleep late, and I hear him very, very quickly fly through the script while I'm trying to figure out where he's at and help correct him. But it's very fun. It's never a dull moment. I love working with Monty, and if I wasn't working with Monty, I'd be sitting at home staring at a wall, so I'm very grateful.
Yeah. What are you seeing emerge in him as he works?
I'm seeing him kind of like discover himself as well, because as he was saying, there's an amount of the play and the part that's already within him. And so whenever he does plays, he kind of takes on aspects of that person, and he matures, he develops as a man and a person. And it's very interesting to see that change in someone, because you can't always, like, if you're playing the part, you can't always tell that you shifted, because it's supposed to be a part of you. You're not supposed to really think about the difference. But when you're looking from the outside, you can see it so much, and it's really a beautiful thing to see. It really is.
When Monty got back from overseas, he immediately mentioned he had two people that he knew would be kind of instrumental to making this work, and Cesar was one, and Eva Engström is the other, who's our stage manager, we haven't gotten a chance to mention her yet, but the four of us will be kind of putting this together when we get into the theater. But so Cesar's been involved in this as long as anybody has from the beginning. And, you know, Eva is working and she's in school, so we're trying to be respectful of her time so that she can join when we really need her, which will be right after Memorial Day.
Yeah, Eva's works just as hard as Cesar. Sorry, Eva, I haven't been giving you the credit. But, Eva is our stage manager, and she helps promote with the flyers, and she's been great. She's got a car. She's driving around all over the place. So if you see her, she's got a bunch of Tom Payne flyers with her. You know, give her a smile. Take a flyer from her.
Maybe two flyers.
Yeah, maybe two. One for a friend as well. We had a lot of tickets to sell for this.
Can you fill our listeners in on a little bit about your trip to Europe during COVID?
Oh, yeah, sure. I went to Ireland, or not, let's see. I did go to Ireland, but I went to France. I went to France for 3 months.
Wow.
And then I went to Ireland for a little bit. And it was kind of, I don't know, I feel like here in town, if you're doing things so often, you're producing a lot of material for people to be consuming, whether you want to or not, you kind of develop a big head. And I didn't really like that, you know? I'm brave enough to admit, like, yeah, I got a big ego from it, and then I just kind of recognize, like, you know, I think I just need to take a break from this and kind of get humbled by the world and just be no one for a while.
Yeah.
And then kind of fall in love with that for a little bit instead of just being known as someone who's always doing something. I wanted to just be able to sit in my own company and not have anything to do to make myself feel proud or meaningful. And it kind of sucked for a little bit. You know. Definitely trying to adjust to that, but I sort of came to terms with it, and in that I got a break from everything I was doing back here, And it was kind of like a little starter trip, you know, because once I'm done with this show at the end of the summer, I'm going to really try and get out of town for good and get a job somewhere else in a city. And I guess that trip was kind of like a demo and come back to Silver with what I've learned, a little bit seasoned by the world, and give them something and then take off again, you know.
Man, there's a lot of interesting theater stuff going on in Europe all the time, too.
Yeah.
I lived over there for a while, and for a couple of years, and my wife started busking in Paris in 1963.
So, wow.
And we've basically, the first time we started going back, that's how we made our living, just going to markets and busking, you know, and it's another kind of performance. And but it keeps you in your place because...
Oh, yeah.
There's nobody saying, go see these people, they're good, or mm-hmm. anything like that. You're just there.
Yep.
And you have to pass something on to them. And it's interesting, instead of just playing or something, you can tell stories once you get them, too. You can say, this tune came from the mountains of northern New Mexico.
Yeah.
You know, and give them a description of it, and they're going, wow. Wow, it's like that there, huh? Wow. And it's not just desert.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, so I mean that's a good thing about traveling is you know, it keeps things in perspective.
Yeah.
And France is lovely. I love France, and Ireland is great.
Mm-hmm.
Ireland and they're very educated if you talk to them, you know.
Yes.
And you can make puns and jokes that are really obscure. And they get them in Ireland. They get them. It's amazing, you know. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, yeah.
So good. Well, welcome back and have good times on your continued journeys.
No, I will, man. Yeah. It's crazy how it took me going over there to realize how good I have it here. You come back and it's just like, I don't know, it's obviously Silver's not perfect. We just had, like, as I was talking about, what a great community to have. Some dude just, like, tried to throw a rock through the window.
No, he didn't try to throw it through.
Oh, they didn't?
No, he just left it. He left it right in front of the front door.
Oh.
It was a gift. I mean, he probably heard us asking for donations.
No.
And he donated a boulder.
Okay, well, he donated a boulder anyway.
Yeah, right.
Coincidentally.
There might be a gold bar inside.
Yeah.
Yes,
as I was talking about the community, how great it is, we were gifted a large rock.
Yes.
But yeah, no, it's just great. It's everyone's very supportive here. And if you go out, I didn't go everywhere, so I can't be like, I've seen the world. But if you go out to a major city, mm-hmm. you'll realize, like, Silver City is a pretty cool place. Everyone's really nice here, for the most part.
And bigger cities have bigger rocks.
They do, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. They've got more places for you to disappear. So he might have, had it been a bigger city, he might have just thrown that sucker in and disappeared. But yeah.
Maybe he really didn't want to throw it in.
Yeah, maybe he got scared at the last minute.
No, I don't know. He just said it right in front of the door.
Really?
Yeah, right in front of the door. He left it there.
What?
And then I looked for him. I couldn't find him. I wanted to thank him for the rock. So if you're out there listening, thank you. And we appreciate your thoughts. You know, and I think he might have, I'm not going to say what he said on the air, but we could just hear from through the window, but he might have mistaken us for another actual fascist station that is in town. Because he said something about you fascists.
Yeah.
So I think he might have us mistaken for, there's another station. I'm not going to say
confusion
the direction, but it's not that far from here.
Confusion is definitely a possibility.
Yes, I think so.
But I think we need to give Cesar one more opportunity and to give our listeners one more opportunity to go get your pencils so that you can see everything about Tom Paine, which is going to be shown at the Buckhorn Saloon and Opera House starting on June 1st.
Yep. All right. Now that you guys have hopefully gotten your writing utensils, if not, tough luck. then the Tom Paine, Based on Nothing, by Will Eno, starring Montelius Valenzuela, directed by Scott Plait, is happening at the Buckhorn Saloon and Opera House, 32 Main Street, Pinos Altos, New Mexico. The performances are June 1st through 30th, Thursday and Friday at 7 p.m., Saturday and Sunday at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. Doors will open 30 minutes prior. If you want to reserve tickets ahead of time, call or text the number 575-956-7249. Or you can text message the email tompainbonticket@gmail.com, which is spelled tompainbonticket@gmail.com.
All right.
Word.
Well, Scott, Cesar, and Monte, thank you very, very much for coming in. We really enjoyed having you as a guest. And, you know, halfway through the month, maybe you can come back.
Yeah, we'd love.
Tell us how it's going.
We would love to.
It'd be a pleasure.
Thank you so much for this show.
All right.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming in.
All right. It was
a pleasure for us as well.
We're going to take a small break here and get ready for the next hour.
Yes.
We're back for the second hour of Local Flavor, which is being broadcast today from the very heights of the Himalayas.
Right.
Because Raul's not here, so we had to take a vacation and go to Nepal.
And for you people who speak English, it's the Himalayas.
Right.
Thank you.
But for this hour, we're especially blessed. We have two superstars. Actually, we have three superstars. We have Heidi Ogas, the head of the High Desert Humane Society, Tim Aldrich, former district judge and former prosecutor and one of my best friends, and Allison Civic, who really doesn't need much of an introduction. The savior of the Gila wilderness, keeping the military out, and for which we are all very, very grateful. Right. So I'm glad you're here, you guys. So
it's great to be here.
Well, you know, Allison, why don't you start off and let our listeners know about what's going on?
Yeah, well, I contacted Raul a couple of weeks ago and said, gee, it's been a while since I've been on Local Flavor. And yeah, we've got some things to update the community on. The first one, because I don't want to forget this, is we have our third annual summer camp, Nature Discovery Summer Camp, coming up in June. And this is funded by the State Outdoor Equity Fund, as well as the Lineberry Foundation. And we're really pleased to have a donation from the Alex Olson and Martin Pearson Donor Advised Fund at the Grant County Community Foundation to support this year's camp. So registration is open. And it's a really fun time this year. We have more resources available, so we're going to be taking three field trips with the kids. We're going to be going to the Gila River. We're going to be going to the Mimbres River and the Mimbres Culture Heritage Site. But what's new this year for the centennial of the Gila Wilderness is a trip to the wilderness with the kids with the Forest Service from the Wilderness District. So we're going to do a hike down Sapio Creek, and the kids will learn about wilderness, why it's important, what is wilderness, and, you know, some of the history. So we're excited about that. So it'll be
New York.
Sorry?
New York.
New York?
It's wilderness.
Wilderness, yes, that's right.
To me, it's wilderness.
We won't be doing the New York wilderness. But this is a day camp. It's every day, 9 to 5 from, 9 to 3, Monday through Friday. The first session starts June 10th. runs through the 14th, and that's in Silver City. The second session is in Silver City, June 17th through the 21st. And then the last session, June 24th through the 28th, is in the Mining District. We're meeting over at the Baird Public Library. So this is really a fun time. We've actually had a number of returning kids. They love it. It's an opportunity for them to be hiking, getting in the outdoors basically all day long, exploring. They learn nature journaling. They learn about birds. They learn about insects, watersheds. They do water testing. I think actually their favorite thing, though, is picking up trash or litter with the trash pickers. That seems to be the most fun activity for them, and sort of the competition of seeing who can get the most litter. Huh. But anyway, yeah, so it's a fun time. We're about halfway full. So if parents are interested, this is for, I should mention, kids that are going into fourth grade through sixth grade. So kids that are just completing third, fourth, and fifth grades, so going into fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. And we would ask that people register by June 3rd. And if you go on our website, silvercitywatershedkeepers.org, you can get the link to the registration form, because it's kind of too long to – or go on our Facebook page, which is Silver City – or SC Watershed Keepers, and there's a QR code on there, and you can just easily get to the form. So,
you know, Tim and I had the good fortune to grow up in Minnesota. And, you know, when thinking back to when I was in the fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, going out to the woods was pretty important to me.
Yeah, when she talked about picking up garbage, I had to laugh. Part of my life experiences is growing up on a family resort, and which meant picking up garbage constantly. And, of course, this was, you know, my growing up was in the late 60s and 70s when everybody smoked, right? And so what ended up on the ground? Mm-hmm. All those cigarette butts. Right. My dad used to always say we'd be, you know, with our coffee cans picking up. We didn't have those fancy little plastic
right.
cans. No. That cost money. That was too much of an investment. You've got kids, you can just bend over, or in my case, kid. But my dad says, you know, we should just drive – this is Minnesota. So we should just drive down to the cities, you know, pull up in some guy's – front of some guy's yard, go out and lay out a blanket and, you know, have a little picnic, smoke a few cigarettes, because that was what people felt like they could do at our place. They could just come in. We were a private resort. We weren't a government facility or anything, but I always got a kick out of that. But that, to this day, one of the things I enjoy, and if you remember when I was a judge – one of the consequences for my drug court people were to come down and pick up garbage. And, of course, I would spend that time with them. And that was really an enjoyable time for me, was being able to just spend time with these folks going through the program and seeing me, or seeing a district court judge, I should say, in a different light. Right. You know?
For sure.
But, yeah, picking up garbage is always good.
Yeah, and I think for me personally, because we also run Pick It Up, Toss No Moss, so our May cleanup, I should put a plug in, our May cleanup is tomorrow at 9 o'clock, 9 to noon. We meet over at the Grant County Community Foundation right by the farmer's market. But, yeah, people say, really? Picking up litter? And it's like, yeah, but for most of my career, I've sat in meeting after meeting after meeting with, like, you know, you think, oh, nothing's coming out of this. I don't see any tangible results from all of this
stuff.
Action. But action. You can go out, you can see a messy, littered area, and you can clean it up and feel like, oh, there's a tangible result. So cleaning up litter is – and, you know, it makes – obviously makes our town, you know, look cared for. Like, people care. I think that's a good message.
I love picking up trash too. When we go camping at least once a month, and that's my goal, is to go around, and I call it micro trash. You know, it's the bottle top. I have to say there's a lot of places that look clean and they don't have the big big trash, but the little bottle tops and the twist off things on juices and little pull tabs on cans. And my two biggest pet peeves are fishing line and glass. Glass is tough. For so sure. Whenever I find unbroken beer bottles, I try to get them picked up right away. That way nobody's tempted to like blast them somewhere. So
that's right. Yeah. So, litter cleanup is one of the things the kids will get to do, and one of the pretty fun things that they like to do. So
I'm glad you're doing this, because when I was in the sixth grade in L.A., the school I went to was mostly poor families and stuff, and the person who the school was named after, Richard Garvey, his family had left money for the sixth graders to go up to the mountains for a week. And they took us up in the San Gabriel Mountains for a week. And I've never forgotten that, because, my dad was working all the time and we didn't take any vacations at that time. And it was amazing to just be up there for a week. And all the kids, hardly any of them had ever been up there. And, we could have actually walked into the San Gabriel Mountains. We could have caught a bus up to, Pasadena and gone up Lake Street and walked right up into the mountains, and we didn't know that.
Right. And, that's really the impetus behind the New Mexico Outdoor Equity Fund, really, that, that was passed by the legislature. I forget what year. It's been at least like 4 years, maybe even 5 years at this point. And the legislature has been appropriating funding for this program every year, and it's been super successful in getting kids from disadvantaged communities across the state in the outdoors. Here we are in the land of enchantment with these amazing places, but oftentimes kids don't get to go out and explore and enjoy. And that's really the impetus behind the Outdoor Equity Fund, is to make sure that every child in New Mexico gets an opportunity to get out there and enjoy the outdoors, learn about the outdoors, learn about nature, learn how to camp, learn how, safety with hiking or camping. I mean, some of the groups across the state that are doing stuff, they're doing amazing, amazing things, rock climbing and, some pretty, pretty exciting things. So
we did. Yeah, we did all that stuff. Didn't you, Joe? Did you do boys? Well, when we were growing up, we had this thing called Boy Scouts.
Right.
Now, apparently, it's called
Scouts, right? Scouts? Just, I think it's just Scouts.
I was watching The Daily Show, and so that's where I get my news from. And the best news source in America, or I should say the United States. I mean, we did all that cool stuff. We did, St. Croix River. We did a huge expedition down the St. Croix River for 10 days. I mean, if that wasn't fun, cliff jumping and picking up garbage.
Picking up garbage.
We took an empty canoe along just to pick up garbage on the way down.
Oh, my.
That was all that stuff. And we taught, back then, again, 60s and 70s, so I grew up in the baby Jesus generation, where you still went to church and they did this thing called confirmation and all that type of stuff. But I remember really learning about, because the youth pastors used to make this commentary in regards to the word dominion. Right, the Old Testament, man shall have dominion. And he'd always point out, no, that's not what that word means. That's an improper translation of that. We are in an interrelationship with it. And of course, my Greek is probably as good as yours, and my line is always, they did a pretty good job on the translation. it's a symbiotic relationship. It's a relationship of responsibility. And to care for that. And that was really that important, cool stuff that when I moved to the South, much different relationships. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because there's maybe more land or something. I always say the difference between how we respond to water as well. Mm-hmm. We seem to care less about it down here where there is none than we do in the far north in Canada and Minnesota, where it's just, that's all you see is water,
Right. Well, you can come down here. You can come down here to the desert. And I know I used to go to the desert instead of the beach living in L.A. And I've always noticed people go out in the desert and they go, there's nothing there, And it's just like you're saying about the trash, And if you go to the desert a lot, you learn to see a lot of things. Whereas if you go up to Portland or somewhere like that, in those mountains, I mean, you can't see the mountains. All you see is big, kind of fuzzy things going up every place, but you can't really see.
Too. That's
see.
Beauty, too.
Well,
it is all beauty.
Yeah, I know it is, but it's claustrophobic, you know.
Spoken like a true desert rat.
Right. Well, it's claustrophobic.
Right.
You walk
don't
in
see
there.
A sunset. Right. Minnesota was like that. Right. We had, unless you got in next to a lake, which I grew up on a lake, but still, when you're in the woods, you're right. You ain't watching no sunsets or sunrises here.
No, nothing there, you know. I mean, when I drive big.
Slapping at mosquitoes all the time.
Yeah, I know, right. And midges, yeah.
Yeah. I think one of the things that always fascinated me about the desert was that there was life out there when it's, 117 degrees and there is no visible water. How a plant or how a lizard can survive in that environment. So that always amazed me as a child. I was fascinated with the desert. Of course, I grew up in New Mexico, so I was used to it. So
yeah,
local, you.
I grew up in New England, but I've been here in Silver City since 1996, so I've been here a while.
Right.
And I wanted to say, this is GRIP's Silver City Watershed Keepers, so Gila. I think I'm with the Gila Resources Information Project. If nobody knows what GRIP means, but we have an organization or a project called the Silver City Watershed Keepers. Right. We're basically trying to educate and raise awareness about the Silver City Watershed Keepers or the Silver City Watershed and facilitate stewardship of the watershed. And, of course, that's a lot of what the kids are learning about is, that importance of water here in our arid environment and amazing biodiversity along these river and stream corridors and how wildlife come down to the creeks and stuff for water. But it's fascinating. And the other thing about our camp is we're bringing in experts. So this year, actually, one group that we're excited about is the Amphibian and Reptile Conservancy. They're going to be with us this year talking about Chiricahua leopard frogs. And Melissa Amarillo from Advocates for Snake Preservation, she's always a hit because she brings her pet gopher snake and a few other snakes and educates kids about snakes and why they're so important and we shouldn't be afraid of them and they
She's
get to
great.
Touch snakes and yeah
she's great. She's really changed my whole out. Not that I was afraid of snakes or disliked them, but she's definitely moved snakes up the chain in my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and we'll have Audubon folks doing birding. Last year the kids got to look they saw through Dave McDonald from Audubon. He's actually an ornithologist, a world-renowned ornithologist that moved to Silver City from University of Wyoming. He brought his scope down for the kids to see the blackhawk nestling in the blackhawk nest down in San Vicente Creek over by the Corbin Street Trailhead. So the kids got to see that little baby blackhawk. And so it really, I think, does instill in all the kids really this love for nature and wonder. They get time to explore and learn. So
that is so much more wholesome than anything I encountered when I was that age. I mean, my introduction to the wilderness was basically, if you had been an Indian child, you would have been able to canoe 50 miles in a day. You would have had bows and arrows and, we were taught, I was basically instructed in how to survive. And the wilderness was really basically the adversity.
Interesting.
It's such an entirely different mindset and it's so much more wholesome,
Yeah, my father would always use phrases that it was interesting. My dad is, it's one of those things where my dad had a disease called frontal temporal dementia, which really, in hindsight, we started noting that affected him really in his probably mid-30s and that. But he used to get a little magazine that was about 7 by 9 inches, and it was called The Environmentalist. Do you remember that, George?
No.
And it always sat on the back of the toilet. Now, my dad, before he died, and he died prior to 2017, I want to say he died in early 2017, but anytime you ask him who he was voting for, he'd say Trump, right? Now, that doesn't sound like a guy who would have an environmentalist magazine on the back, but he used to say these types of things. He said, Tim, we are not sportsmen. We are not out there shooting things for the fun of it. We're hunters, and we were. We were hunter, trapper, gatherers. We did the blueberry thing. We did the wild rice thing. We did the tapping of maple tree things. We did trapping of everything. In fact, we were joking when I was up this spring that the trees were just down along the shores like crazy, the popple and the birch. As I drove up, I said to my brother, what on earth's going on? And he said, he looked at me, he said, well, he said, Dad and Ed, our cousin, aren't here to trap them anymore. And so they're just flooding, you know, they're trying to get people out trapping again because the beaver populations are going crazy and up in these northern areas. And of course, they dam everything. That's what they're supposed to do and that. But he always had that interesting view of it. He was anti-snowmobile. But so you never saw me in a snowmobile. It was always cross country skiing. All of those types of things. He was quirky and unique, but at the same time he'd vote for Trump.
Go figure.
Well, and he was a businessman. You know, he was. We owned a resort. He was very conservative. You know, I think once I went to college, I taught him libertarianism and those types of things. And mm-hmm. you know, he moved into the thoughts of John Stuart Mill and others, and was just a character. And then, of course, he's just a character. He's just a character. Right. That dementia makes you funnier than hell, too.
Talking about the beaver problem and stuff, I think it's so important for our children and our next generations to understand that we are going to leave a footprint, but we have to manage that footprint, because if we go in and wipe out one particular thing or use up too much of it, then something else unnaturally can take over, even if it was something natural to start with. You know, I always think of the Pete Seeger song where the people are scratching. I don't know if you remember that song where he talks about, you know, there's a problem with the mice in the town, so they eradicate the mice, and then the cats are going hungry, and then the fleas don't have any place to live, so they have to live on the people, and so the people are scratching because they're covered with fleas because they've eliminated everything else. So
probably comes out of some type of middle ages, don't you think?
I don't know.
Well, when you think about, I think about the plague, right? And,
right.
And
yeah.
Mice and fleas and all of those wonderful things. Oh.
Yeah, but it could have been written by what's her name, who wrote Little Boxes with Pete Seeger and all that. Reynolds. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll have to look it up. I'll have to look it up now.
Yeah, right.
Right. Yeah, right. We have one of these devices.
I know.
It's made out. Now we know what gold is for, right?
We used to just think
it was pretty, and now we understand that. Holy smokes.
Yeah, it has actual value. No, it's a made-up value.
Right,
yes.
Right.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Allison, what else is going on with the, you know, I know, and I think it's important for our listeners to know that you've been doing all this work with the riparian area for San Vicente Creek. It's great work.
Yeah, we've through the State Environment Department River Stewardship Program, we have been doing restoration of San Vicente Creek, as you said, removing non-native elm, Siberian elm, and tree of heaven, and tamarisk from San Vicente Creek and the two tributaries, Silva Creek and Pinos Altos Creek. We've been working on town property as well as some private property owners and some county property. So we've completed 55 acres of non-native tree removal. We've also been constructing check dams to slow urban stormwater runoff down some of a tributary, in particular Agave Arroyo, which actually comes down into San Vicente Creek. There's a sewer line that runs actually, the main sewer line through the town runs down San Vicente Creek, PA Creek, and a lot of these tributaries too. We use gravity, right, to push our wastewater through the sewer line down to the wastewater treatment plant. Well, unfortunately, people know when the big ditch floods, when we get these high precipitation events, you know, the Silver City watershed is 38 square miles. When you get all that water being concentrated coming down Silva, PA Creek, and then concentrating in the big ditch and flowing down San Vicente Creek, you can get some pretty huge floods. Stream bank erosion undermines the sewer line. So, you know, we've done a lot with armoring stream banks with planting willows. We've partnered with the Youth Conservation Corps kids at Aldo Leopold Charter School, and we've planted, probably at this point well over 1,000 willows, probably over 1,200 willows at this point, and unbelievable growth. The willows, we've had close to 100% success rate, and they're doing a terrific job of protecting stream banks. And, you know, the thought is that over time, if we remove the elms and the Tree of Heaven, which unfortunately, because we have such a degraded riparian corridor, and they were comprising most of the tree canopy, the majority of the tree canopy, once we remove that, those species, then the native cottonwoods, the willows, the box elders, they're going to have more light, they're going to have more water, and then they're going to take off and then become the dominant species in the tree canopy. And of course, that helps wildlife. These trees are adapted to this area, so they do better. They're less fire prone. That's the other thing. We all know that Big Ditch Park in San Vicente Creek, we've had, over 50 fires, little fires started over the last year or so. Very fire prone.
Last year?
Yes. 50? Yes. 50, at least 50.
There was a lot of problems with the homeless.
Yeah.
In fact, our thrift store quit putting clothes out in the free box because they were finding clothes being used to start the fires.
You're right up here.
Our PAWS cause, yeah.
Yeah, so thankfully, people have been very observant, reported the fires, and the fire department has put them out very quickly. But hey, given this very fire-prone area, drought, you know, we could be in a serious situation. So that's a lot of, as well, what we've been doing is removing the slashed, the dead, down, woody stuff, pruning branches, and really trying to help make the landscape a little less fire prone. So
that's how do you remove a Siberian elm?
The method that we've used is so we had two subcontractors, so Gila Woodnet and Southwest Tree Solutions, and you cut the Siberian elm, so cut it down, but then you apply an herbicide, kind of paint it on the stump right after you cut it. It's got to be fresh. And we've had a very good success rate with killing the elm trees. And, you know, we go back. Sometimes it takes – Tree of Heaven is really tough.
Yeah.
You have to go back.
Trees from hell.
Yes. Yeah, so you have to go back multiple
difficult.
Times with
yeah.
Tree of Heaven.
So what do you do to them to get the Tree of Heaven?
Sorry?
What do you do to get rid of the Tree of Heaven?
Well, the Tree of Heaven usually takes a number of applications. I mean, what we've experimented with some different methods, like so we've cut them, we've applied. I mean, the bigger trunks or stems, you know, like actual trees are are easier to eradicate, but it's those thickets of the little tiny diameter stems that are really tough. So what we did was we kept chopping the leaves off, so weaken the plant, because obviously the plant, the trees need to photosynthesize to get energy. If they don't have any leaves, they can't do that. So we chop the leaves off, weaken the stems, then you can pull them up. Or, you know, if they're thicker, then you can hit them with the herbicide and have a much better success rate. So we've, you know, we in some areas we had really good success. Other areas, like the thickety tree of heaven, it took a lot more work. And then, you know, right now we're going back now that the tree of heaven is in some areas is starting to resprout again. We've got to just take care of those resprouts. But
They're tough. They're tough trees. I live out sort of in the juniper pinon forest, and it's like up sprouts this Siberian elm. I'm like, what? But I've cut it down and put salt on it, and it grows back, and I've cut it down and it grows back. And
You're listening. Yeah.
So it's. Oh, sorry, George.
We're at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico. We're here with Allison Civic, Tim Aldridge, Heidi Ogas, and we're having a great conversation. How do you get rid of those trees?
Well, the question I had then is, so is Siberian elm the same thing as trees from heaven?
No. Two different species.
Okay, two different species here to torture us.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, our watershed, as everybody knows the story, right, that, you know, when Europeans first came to this area, people needed wood, right? So to build houses, for fuel, to cook, to keep warm. So, you know, of course people thought, well, there are like infinite number of trees. Let's just go cut them all down, right? Well, of course, the watershed got completely denuded, not only cutting trees down for fuel, but then also we had cattle grazing, sheep and cows, and ate all the grass. So then there was nothing to hold the soil, right? And so it rained, and then we had these catastrophic floods that basically washed away Welcome Big Ditch, all the way down to bedrock, 40 feet deep in some places. So our entire watershed is in the process of healing itself. Unfortunately, you know, this is when people didn't know any better, right? We brought in Tree of Heaven. We brought in elm because the Siberian elm, because remember the Dutch elm disease back east that devastated the native elm, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so the thought was Siberian elm would be more resistant. So that tree was brought in. Tree of Heaven is considered a pioneer species, right? Because it can go in there and colonize an area. It's so good at doing that, right? So
very good.
Right. So it can take over. It's fast growing. So, you know, there were reasons why these species were brought in. But then, of course, you know, they took over.
It backfired.
And so, you know, we really, if we want to have a native cottonwood forest through the San Vicente Creek, we've got to make sure that, you know, those cottonwoods, those willows, those box elders, all those native trees are not out-competed by these non-native tree species. So we got to – unfortunately, humans have to sort of interfere or interject themselves, right, to manage and make sure that, you know, we can get these native tree species to become dominant again in the canopy.
So, Siberian elms are those ones that blow all those little round tan seeds all over the place. Yep.
Well spinners are
a maple trees.
That's a maple, yeah.
These are just tiny little round things about the size of a dime. They're flat and they have a seed right in the center. And when they blow around, it looks like a snowstorm.
They're the ones that come into the house every single week.
Yep. That's them. That's your Siberian elm.
Yeah. So
actually, before all the people came to cut down the trees and graze the land, before all that happened, you know, in the era of the mountain men, I did not know that there was a very large beaver population all along the Gila River. And there were a very large number of beaver dams, all of which basically got eliminated by the Hudson Bay Company.
Ohio Patti and all of the other early trappers.
Right, Kit Carson.
Mm-hmm. Kit Carson, that guy was actually kind of one of them scary guys.
Yeah.
In hindsight, I remember reading about him as a young child, admiring him and that. And, of course, it's like everything as we grow up, especially those of us who grew up in our Anglo-painted culture. Just was so white. It was unbelievable. And it's amazing the difference. I had some friends that I went over to the Final Four this year, but stayed with some friends of mine that are from Minnesota, and we're going through the changing the flag process. And so and they grew up. I've known them since I was in grade school. And he said to me, he said, "Why are they changing it? Explain to me what's going on. What's wrong with this flag?" And I said, "Okay, well, here's how I taught it." And the Minnesota flag basically has a picture of the sun. There's a Native American that's riding on horseback, riding in front of the sun, and then in the foreground, you have a stump with a farmer and a single, basically a cow pulling a single plow, and he's behind it with a gun, leaning on the stump. And I said, "Well, this is how it was taught to me in second grade by Mrs. Munt." And Mrs. Munt taught it this way. And first off, she used the word savages. She said, "Now note the savages that are on the horseback there. Now look at him. Now look at the farmer." And, of course, we were the farmers at lunchtime when we'd come back in to settle us down, you know, from having that 30 minutes of running like crazy to get all that energy out. Our teachers would read us such things as Little House in the Big Woods. And so we were those immigrants that came in, and there was nobody else around, and we got this magical free land so we could farm on and everything else. But she said, "Now look at him, look at his gun. He's protecting his land from the savages." And I said, that's it. And he was like, he looked at both of them, did like, I had never heard it. You know, they had never thought of it that way in that paradigm. So I forget what the actual flag ended up looking like. If we had a distorted loon and kind of one of those real simplistic three-color type things.
Mm-hmm. The flag actually has been officially changed now.
Yeah. And which one did we go with, though?
The three-color one. There's a blue two shades of blue, the water and the sky.
In the land of right. Sky blue waters.
Anyway,
wow, this is some.
But that's, you know, what Tim is saying is exactly the line I got growing up.
Right.
And, you know, the wilderness was not your friend. It's something that had to be conquered.
Yeah. I never had that experience. I didn't really, you know, I grew up more rural, obviously, so
right.
The woods was just fun. It's fun.
Yeah. But that's, you know, in addition to the work that GRIP is doing with the riparian areas, there's a grant out there, a $5 million grant for planting trees, and I'm interested in hearing what's going on with that.
Sure. Well, we are, that is a U.S. Department of Agriculture, U.S. Forest Service grant. GRIP and Western New Mexico University put a proposal together, actually almost a year ago now, to set up a Southwest New Mexico Community Forestry Network. And do community forestry plans for six communities in southwestern New Mexico, Silver City, Baird, Hurley, Santa Clara, Deming, and Lordsburg, and really support tree planting, tree care in southwestern New Mexico. And the goal of this big, it was just, this is through the Inflation Reduction Act. So the goal of this big grant program through the Urban and Community Forestry Program of the Forest Service was really to address tree equity issues in disadvantaged communities across the country. So this, all of these grants are really focused on making sure that disadvantaged communities and neighborhoods have trees and have a tree canopy. Trees, as we all know, serve, you know, have amazing benefits, right? We're entering, you know, climate change. I mean, we're already here with climate change, but, you know, with in New Mexico in particular, with over the next 50 years, our average temperatures are supposed to increase by 5 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit. We're going to get hotter and drier. Heat waves are going to become more frequent. Trees provide mitigation of the urban heat island effect. So think about the sun heating up the asphalt on the streets or the concrete, the houses, you know, that ink right there creates like a huge warming effect. But if we can plant trees and create shade, we can have cooling. And so we want to bring the benefit of trees to neighborhoods and communities that don't have enough tree canopy. And of course, you know, trees also serve loads of other benefits like wildlife habitat and help with stormwater, like we talked about with the big ditch, right? Mental health, that's a huge issue. There's been loads of research out there on how trees and greenery, gardens, parks, how that just really helps learning and also helps our mental health. So all of these benefits of trees, and so we're starting to kick off this program. We'll be meeting with all of our municipalities and the counties and starting to, you know, get the process going. Community forestry plans will be done first with full community engagement. So it'll be up to the communities to decide, like, you know, what do we want to do for tree planting? You know, what do we want the future of community forestry to look like in our communities? And part of the Southwest New Mexico Community Forestry Network will be to support those activities over the long term. This is a 5-year grant. We'll be planting 1,000 trees across southwestern New Mexico, as well as doing lots of like tree giveaways for people to plant trees in their homes or in their yards. Lots of education going on. So that's the component that GRIP is managing. The university is also putting in place a tree worker certificate program, because with all of this restoration work and urban and community forestry being a big focus area, you know, there's a need for educated tree workers. So they'll be doing a certificate program essentially in arboriculture. And also the campus, the university is going to be expanding its arboretum too. So maybe Western can come on the show and tell you more about their plans, because our portion is just, you know, more of the community engagement, the tree planting and the development of the community forestry plans. But we're really super excited to finally get going on this project.
So if you're planting 1,000 trees, the trees have to come from somewhere. Where are the seedlings coming from?
Yeah, well,
lots of nurseries.
Yes. So that is one thing that this project we hope will help foster and facilitate and support local growers. And so, for instance, the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, Mike Fugali and Carol Ann Fugali, they've been starting a program called Seedlings to Saplings down at the old Chinese gardens under one of the big greenhouses. Is, you know, part of the vision is to basically grow local tree and shrub species here to help in all of these restoration projects. So part of this project, too, is to help support and facilitate local growers. So if you're a local grower out there, give us a buzz and, you know, let us know how we can support you, because you're right. You know, we've got to have plants that are adapted to this right. area, you know.
Yeah. So yeah, I think you first thing, you inspired somebody, because and they reminded me of, if you're going to have trees, they have to have water. And so somebody from Stream Dynamics called and says, we'd like to be on the show. They were inspired by the show. And, you know, to keep water where and plant and grow trees and not sacrifice the water to concrete.
Right, absolutely. Things. And they're one of our contractors on right. this project. So, like, what we're hoping is, to the extent that we're planting trees in parks, for mm-hmm. instance, right. we can do some of the curb cuts and rainwater harvesting right. That can act as supplemental water for right. for the trees that we plant. So, yes, Stream Dynamics, is as well as Southwest Tree Solutions, Joseph Franklin Owens, they're right. both contractors on this project, and we'll be able to help with all the tree care and tree pruning and Stream Dynamics with all the rainwater harvesting. And our project will also serve as an on-the-job training sort of mm-hmm. Field work component to the certificate program at the university. So any students that are in that program can come help out on these projects and learn how to learn, you know, on the job, learn mm-hmm. how to do curb cuts or learn how to plant trees or learn how to prune trees, all those things. So
right. it was Stream Dynamics, too, that put me in touch with somebody at New Mexico State University, because I had a globe willow in my yard. And I had heard on a horticulture program, you know, that they take 90 gallons a day of water. It was just insane the amount of water they needed to have. And so I wanted to remove that tree, but I wanted to put something in that was maybe not necessarily native, but that would help the environment rather than suck up all the water. So they told me to plant the red push pistache.
Okay.
Which, once established, takes very, very little water and lives on their own. So,
great. And, you know, we are collaborating with the Tree Alliance and Tree New Mexico. And these are groups, you know, based up in Albuquerque and Santa Fe. But they're hoping to basically create this statewide network. Right. And a lot of effort's been put into, you know, developing the list of drought tolerant trees for all the different areas of the state, and really doing community outreach and education so that people know how to take care of their trees, how to water,
yes.
how not to overwater.
Yes. And also when you talk about, you know, planting like non-native, not only ones that won't suck up the water, but also ones that will not take over, like the Siberian
right,
elm and the
sure.
tree of heaven, that I just want the one tree that's what I need for shade in my yard. And I don't want to populate with something that's non-native, but I want to be able to use the tree itself. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so that's that. You'll hear more. We're just like literally just getting started. So, you know, yeah. as we progress a little bit
well,
more,
have,
I'd love to come back and talk to you
about it. As you have the program and people can get licensed, they're like seeds that can spread across the country.
Absolutely.
You know?
There you go.
Yeah, yeah. I was just thinking, I saw a poem the other day, and the last couple lines was, I choose to risk my significance to live so that which came to me as seed goes to the next as blossom, and that which came to me as blossom goes on as fruit.
Oh. Nice.
Yeah.
I love that. That's a lovely
yeah.
quote. And who was that?
It was somebody named Donna Markova in 1942. It was just in somebody
nice.
Else's Substack thing. And I said, so it's not a very long poem altogether, but that's the last part of it. And I really like that part.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Yeah, it is. So
are there any other projects
Yeah, well, one thing I did want to talk to you all about, and I'm really excited to for this project, is called the Grant County Airwise Project. GRIP has been collaborating with the University of New Mexico, New Mexico Integrative Science Program, incorporating research in the environmental sciences. It's New Mexico Inspires. I know. Everybody loves these. I'm learning university researchers love acronyms, you know. Anyway, so the New Mexico Inspires program, funding from the federal government, from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. But we've been working now for the past couple of years on developing a particulate air quality monitoring network for Grant County. And we've just gotten out our first 8 samplers, one of which is right up here on the radio station's tower. And so
is that up on the mountain or is it?
No, right here. Right. You're one right here. Yeah. So it's operating off of a solar panel. And
Is there a reason why we're doing this? Are there concerns that we're having?
Absolutely. So, you know, this is really part of a vision for climate adaptation and resilience, right? As I mentioned earlier, as we get hotter and drier, the risk of wildfire increases. You know, we also need to, you know, Forest Service is doing prescribed burns too. But also dust events end up increasing. We also get a lot of transport from urban areas like Phoenix and El Paso, depending upon the weather. And what this network is going to do is provide real-time air quality data to Grant County residents. And Grant County actually has one of the highest adult prevalence rates for asthma in the state. And so what this air quality data will do is help people get that real-time air quality concentrations and understand, especially if they're asthmatic or they have any other respiratory conditions, gee, maybe I need to stay indoors today or not exercise outdoors, depending upon concentration. So really, this air quality network is going to help people protect their health.
Or go back to masking temporarily.
Or, you know, there are also indoor air filters too that you can get. So this will be a tool for us here in Grant County, you know, to really, you know, become more aware of air quality issues, air pollution issues, but then also take it a step further and provide information to protect public health, essentially.
Where will the data, the real-time data, be available?
So the monitors are all Purple Air monitors. So if you go to the Purple Air website, you can plug in our zip code and you can see where the general location of all of the air quality monitors. And like I said, we're still in the process of getting monitors deployed. So we hope to have better coverage throughout the county. But we will be downloading the data, but it also is up in the cloud, you know. So basically when you set up these samplers, they work on Wi-Fi and they upload every 10 minutes the data to the Purple Air website and people can see the air quality over the last few days. But then we'll be downloading and analyzing the data, because really what we want to do is to be able to understand kind of what the current state of air quality is here, where sources are, emission sources are, you know, is there anything we can be doing here in terms of mitigation strategies? We'll be doing a lot of communicate public, you know, public communication too in terms of public health.
Well, maybe you can try to deal with the completely uneducated people who can't be educated, and explain to some of the DJs here how we can get that data.
Yes, absolutely. We will be doing that. So, like I said, when we're done kind of getting these, the rest of the network up and running, we'll be, helping you guys. I mean, you'll be able to, you know, on a, just go to the website and be able to look at the monitor and be able to say, here's what air quality is in downtown Silver City right now.
All right. Well, you know, Heidi has been a great participant in today's show, but she hasn't had a chance to talk about dogs. And before you get going, Heidi, I learned while getting ready for this show that if you have a husky, if it's more than 86 degrees outside, it's a life-threatening kind of situation for
very
the dog.
Very much so. Very much so.
And you need to make sure that the dog is very well hydrated and in a cool place, which is less than 86 degrees.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, they're very – so I only have one dog that I want to share today, and then we'll try to get Ken to do his calendar. But we still have Hercules.
We have Hercules
at the animal shelter, and he is a Malamute St. Bernard mix. And he's a very gentle dog. He is young, though, so when you first greet him, he's kind of rambunctious. But he's a big, big dog. When he stands up on his hind legs, the top of his head is at about 6 feet.
Is he over 100 pounds?
Oh, yes. He's, I'm going to say 150 pounds or more. He's a very, very big dog. And he's been with us for over a month, and so we're really trying to find a home for him. Our pens are not that big. We do have an outdoor pen that is about 15 by 15. So he spends a lot of time out there. Just trying to get some better exercise than keeping him inside in a cage that when he stands up, his head hits the top of the cage. So we really need to find Hercules a home. Like I said, for a big dog, he's very, very gentle, and he's a real sweetheart. He's even learning some manners like sit. He walks really well on a leash. He'll pull a little bit in the beginning, but that's about it. So he doesn't look like, he looks, I would say, more like a Malamute than he does a St. Bernard. He's sort of cream-colored and almost German Shepherd-y head-shaped, but he's a beautiful dog. So if you know somebody that would like a really good hiking dog that could even probably carry his own backpack, Hercules would be the one for you. So,
all right.
It's all yours, Ken.
All right. Well, I was just looking at the purple thing here.
You have 2 minutes.
You've got about a minute.
All right. The only thing that's happening tonight is Friday, May 17th. That's tonight, 7 to 8 p.m., Ditch Spear opening night, Big Ditch Park, south of Main Street Plaza. And they have a show tonight at 7 p.m., tomorrow night at 7 p.m., Sunday at 2 p.m. and 6 p.m., and Monday at 6 p.m., which will be the last one. So you got this weekend to watch Ditch Spear. You know, Shakespeare in the ditch, you know. So, and I actually, if you listen tomorrow morning on Roots and Branches, I will give you some more events.
That's a good idea because
it's
we're
time
out
to go.
Of time.
Thank you for listening.
I really appreciate Tim and Heidi and Allison coming in. Thank you very much for all of you, for all the things you do for our community.
You're welcome.
All right.
And thanks for the invitation to be on the show.
And thank you, George.
All right.
Remember, KURU. Time, talents, and treasures.